I'm Bob Garfield with an On the Media podcast extra. Last Tuesday, Donald Trump won the Indiana primary and became the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. In the days that followed, ink was spilled and hands were wrung, including two pieces in the New York Times, over the question, how did we get this so wrong? In a piece titled, The Republican Horse Race is Over and Journalism Lost, Times columnist Jim Rutenberg was particularly critical of so-called data journalism, which a mere one election cycle ago seemed so heroic, but in Trump world turned out to have feet of clay. Rutenberg singled out Nate Silver's 538, our partner this election cycle, and the Times' own The Upshot. On the dangers of relying on polling data, Rutenberg wrote that 6 months ago, when 538 gave Trump a 2% chance of winning the nomination, the low probability, quote, sapped the journalistic will to scour his record as aggressively as those of his supposedly more serious rivals. In other words, predictions can have consequences. Nate Silver, on his podcast this week, had a response to Rutenberg and all the other data detractors. We're going to play an excerpt from that episode in which you'll also hear Silver's 538 colleagues, Harry Enten and Claire Malone. Host Jody Avergan kicked off the discussion, asking Nate what questions he thinks the media at large should be asking in the wake of Trump's win.
Well, the number one question is, how did a demagogue win a major party nomination? You know, there was a piece over the weekend that came out about Donald Trump and fact-checking, and not only does he have the worst record that factcheck.org and whatever else I've ever tracked, but he doesn't even bother to respond to fact-checks anymore. It's a purely post-empirical world, but people, Republicans at least, tend to trust him. They tend not to trust the media. A lot of chickens have come home to roost. You know, meanwhile, this is a guy that got blanket wall-to-wall coverage, 70% of the coverage at the GOP primary when you originally had 17 candidates. So, you know, first check your own bed and see if it's in order. If you're the New York Times media columnist and you think, oh, everything the Times did was fine and dandy, let's kind of take random pot shots at other people. And we, by the way, are saying, let's look at our process and see where our thought press was wrong and right and think about that. You know, to me, that's kind of smug, I suppose, number one, but also is why data journalism is going to triumph in the end, is because we actually have a process toward improvement that's part of the scientific method. When something is wrong, we reflect on it. Sometimes, by the way, you can overreact. You can say, you know what, this year you looked really smart if early on in the race you said, trust the polls, don't worry about endorsements, that's all crap, right? 4 years ago, just the opposite was true. You look smart if you said that Herman Cain's going to fade and Gingrich and Santorum and Michelle Bachmann. So, you know, it's important not to overlearn those lessons, but it is important to kind of review your thought process. We've had a couple pieces already. We have a couple more coming out. So I don't know.
So for people who didn't see your piece where you talked about what lessons you feel like you learned as a political scientist and as a journalist, do you want to talk about what's...
So there's one level on which we can say, let's kind of give the play-by-play of how Trump won, what things that we didn't expect. You know, this thing we talked about in the first half of the show where, you know, I was surprised how much Republican voters moved away from conservatism as defined by Paul Ryan or Ronald Reagan or even George W. Bush. That surprised me, how powerless and how big this conflict was within the GOP. I suppose I wasn't surprised by, after the first few months, by how much the media covered Trump, but I did think that eventually people might get bored, and if Trump stopped dominating the news cycle, it might be a somewhat different type of race. But I think it is important to kind of zoom out and say kind of fundamentally what was right or wrong. I mean, we make predictions based on history. You can go back, and I counted before Trump roughly 6 to 8 candidates who at some point led in national polls but were disapproved by party elites, who were unconventional in some ways. That ranges from Newt Gingrich to George Wallace to Jerry Brown, who led Bill Clinton late in 1992. So you kind of have a case where historically Trump-like candidates, defined broadly, were 0 for 6 or 0 for 8. There are some borderline cases like Howard Dean, for example. You know, how do you predict when there's no precedent, but on the other hand, you only have a sample size of 6 or 8 and it's a changing universe? It's actually a fairly difficult question.
I mean, Harry, you wrote about that too. That seems to be one of the big lessons, is just that it's a small sample size with these presidential elections, right?
Right. I mean, that's, you know, we try and base things empirically and try and look back at history. But if the history is, you know, two cans, three bottles, and, you know, whatever else, it's not really much of anything historical to look after. And so we try to be empirical about it, but empiricism only leads you so far. And I think the big thing looking forward is maybe be a little more careful. And I think Nate does a better job of that than I do. I'm sort of a cocky son of a gun who comes from the hard streets of New York, and I think I know what the heck I'm
Riverdale.
Talking about.
Do you feel bad about making some of the sort of more out there statements about Trump's chances that you did? Or
no, I don't feel bad. I feel bad that I sometimes go on the subway and maybe don't give the homeless person a little extra money than I should. That makes me feel bad.
Can I say something though, as like a person who is not of your data mining world, but like lives in close proximity, but also I think I understand, and like I've worked in places in the past where people are a little bit suspicious of data. No one's suspicious of data, but like the way that this fight unfolds to me, and it happens, I think often, is this sort of tribalism of like newspapers and old school reporting and empirical journalism or whatever. And it, to me, just looking at it and like reading the Times article, there just seems to be sort of like a fundamental lack of understanding that when you guys are pulling out polls and like making models and looking back at history, there is a human element in all of this, right? Which is that it's learned experience. It's deciding what elements are most important. And at the end of the day, it's sort of interpretation.
You mentioned kind of in passing that some of it's tribal. This guy, Jim Rutenberg.
We should just say Jim Rutenberg wrote this column for the New York Times, which was the one that sort of most kind of took a shot at data journalism.
David Carr slot.
Right.
Jim Rutenberg and I were colleagues at the time in 2012 when 538 was a part of the New York Times. They were incredibly hostile and incredibly unhelpful to 538, particularly when 538 tried to do things that blended reporting with kind of more classic techniques of data journalism. You know, when we went to New Hampshire, for example, you go to the New York Times filing center and the political desk is like literally giving us the cold shoulder like it's some high school lunchroom. I mean, this happened, right? When we filed the story, kind of pointing out before anyone else at the Times did or very many other people in the media did that Rick Santorum had probably won the Iowa caucus, and that was a story that involved a combination of data work and reporting. We actually happened to talk to Rick Santorum, a couple of people with campaigns. They were apoplectic because their Romney sources were upset and their Iowa GOP sources were upset. So a story that, number one, was a perfect blend of reporting, which is what Rutenberg claims we need with data, and number two, got things totally right, pissed them off because they were mad, they didn't get the scoop, it went against what their sources wanted. I mean, this guy was extremely unhelpful. He's like, well, we all need to go out there and talk to voters. You know what polls are? Polls are a way of talking to voters on a larger scale while minimizing bias. It's a whole conceit of doing polling to begin with.
It strikes me that we are also in a period of change, and like maybe this is a new emerging segment of journalism, and this is a little bit maybe like labor pains that are going on, where I think the Times in a lot of ways has come, like people are coming around, and empirical database stuff where you look at polls, where you use models is becoming more and more of the mainstream, but there is still, I think there exist probably factions.
For sure. I mean, you know, the fact is that the news industry as a whole is not doing well, right? If everything is growing by 10%, then we can have an all go along and get along attitude. But I think sometimes people need to be called out. And this is someone who, by the way, doesn't talk about the fact that we were colleagues together at the New York Times, right? This is a person who cherry picks the facts that he's looking at. So he mentions that our Indiana prediction for the Democratic election, the underdog won, but in fact, the favorite has won 51 out of 56 times in our polls only forecast. You know, to me, that's dishonest and unethical, frankly. And he doesn't really take the time to understand what's going on. By the way, this guy also, in 2011, 4 years ago, when Donald Trump was also polling very well, didn't wind up entering, wrote a column about that was as snide and dismissive as you can imagine, said anyone who was looking at these Donald Trump polls and thinks they're for real is a joke. We all know it's such a publicity stunt. It will never happen. So it's pure hypocrisy and tribalism. I believe there are good versions of a critique of data journalism, but the fact that this guy is a spokesperson speaks to how petty
Let me take one step back and ask a question about the sort of notion of data journalism, which is, for context, right, Harry, if you had been like a pure data journalist and done what I think a lot of people kind of think we do, but we don't actually do, which is just look at polls and only polls, you would have done pretty well because Trump was leading in the polls from the jump, right?
Well, yeah, and I want to say that there are multiple ways in which you can, you know, do polls and this, that, and others. So, yeah, I mean, Donald Trump led in something like 91% of the national primary, Republican primary polls that were taken once he entered in later. And it was something like he led in 75% of them in July, and then it kind of just took off from there. Statewide, the same numbers, if not higher, in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Florida. But oftentimes, you know, he led it with 25% of the vote, and his favorable ratings weren't that hot, though they got better as once he entered the race. But there was plenty of other stuff that, you know, we look at, you know, mm-hmm. that historically has been more highly correlated with the actual result than the actual national primary polls, which have historically been not all that predictive. So we didn't, you know, we just looked at and said, hey, you know, yes, this is there. But as it turns out with Trump, it wasn't only there. It was also not only just an accurate portrayal of what was going to happen, but he picked up his fair share of voters as the primary went on. But there is no guarantee that that will happen next time. It didn't happen last time. And I just go back to the point, generally speaking, the real lesson for me in this isn't that there's necessarily one predictor that's better than another, but that we just need to be maybe a little more cautious of exactly how we're presenting things. And I talk about that not as for this website in particular, but me. Talk about navel gazing, because I'm always looking to improve. And I think that's one of the keys going forward is we're always looking to improve. You look at my record or you look at whatever, there are plenty of mistakes in there, but hopefully the pluses outweigh the minuses. And
well, they do, though. I mean, this isn't our first rodeo.
No.
It's one thing if you say, at one point I said, I think Donald Trump had a 2% chance of winning, 5% went up over time. You know, if you're going to make that claim and say, well, this was kind of a wild and crazy thing, then it helps to have a track record where you do have hundreds of elections behind your name. But I do want to say, I do think that, as you're saying, Harry, the kind of, oh, just should we have paid more attention to the poll story, in some ways it's kind of a flattering story for us to say, well, I'd be even more attentive to the polls. But it is more complicated than that. The early national polls had mispredicted several winners in a row. There were some polls that were less flattering to Trump. For example, his favorables were improved, but were still meh for a front runner. Iowa and New Hampshire, for points of time, those polls were kind of meh. And historically, factors like endorsements have predictive power, too. You know, I think a somewhat more subtle mistake, a more important mistake, is that, you know, the predictions when I said we did our subjective odds a year or so ago, those weren't based on models. Those were based on ad hoc, you're kind of versed in the literature, but, you know, but if I kind of look at this and eyeball it and say, well, not impossible that he'll win, but he is ahead in the polls, right? 2%, 5%, you know, that's kind of arbitrary. If you go through the work of actually building a model, it forces you, number one, to formalize things. And number two, the best part about a model is that even if you initially build the model with some assumptions that are wrong, if it's a well-designed model, it tends to correct itself over time. So maybe if a model originally said Donald Trump only has a 5% chance, maybe by November, when you have these terrorist attacks, he begins rising in the polls, they become more meaningful. We say, you know what? Donald Trump has a 25% chance now, a little bit ahead of where the conventional wisdom has him. We know maybe we'd round down a bit for endorsements and whatnot, but if you don't have a model, then all of a sudden you're kind of flailing about and making a lot of the same mistakes that that other pundits do.
But Claire, with regards to, you know, we all kind of have this model in our heads that we're in our set of priors and the kind of ways that we test it as the election goes on. And I'm just curious how, you know, the people who defend, quote unquote, traditional reporting, political reporting, would say, you know, we don't trust sources enough. We don't trust what we see on the ground enough. We don't trust kind of like the you know, vibe or feel or whatever. I mean, you wrote a piece about Trump where you talked about talking to voters, going to Trump events and seeing the energy that's there. So how do you work that in? Do you feel like we didn't trust that enough? Just the kind of like we're in this space and we're seeing something is happening. And how do you fit that in?
Well, I think, I mean, I might not directly answer your question, but I also think there's something I want to say up front that, like, you know, I think of the writing that I do or the reporting that I do as being more magazine reporting than newspaper reporting. And I think that's an important difference. Like, the Times, the Post have tons of reporters out on the ground on any given day in lots of different parts of the country. And they are telling the, you know, the stories that we read. I mean, would say everyone at this table reads the New York Times political section probably pretty faithfully, mm-hmm. and other newspapers. And it's really great to have. And they're very invaluable things that come from that sort of like close-up reporting. And then I think that things like magazine journalism, it's sort of like an old line that like you take the newspaper reporting and you try to like zoom 30,000 feet up. And that's kind of how I think of the writing and reporting I try to do here. And also I think that fits really well with data, right? Which is that, yeah, you're not doing the like literally like what happened today, even though what happened today is important because it grows and it aggregates into a larger story of 2016. But the idea that numbers help with the 30,000 foot up, and also, you know, but you also want to have the voices of human beings who are in there and looking at particular states and particular cities and particular demographics, Mormons, evangelicals, like all of those. If you want to like slice demographic pie, you need numbers for it. And that's a story that we would tell, and that's a story that the New York Times would tell. But some of it is just these, you know, how close up is your reporting and how fast twitch is it versus long twitch.
And eventually we all want it to just sort of mix and blend and
eventually
be just good reporting,
be,
and the terms,
you know,
should just
we
disappear.
Don't go about, yeah. You know, maybe I'll start calling traditional journalists like anecdote journalists, right, or something like that. We all want to get along, and you're right. In the long run, it all kind of goes away. We're all just journalists, and some of us have slightly different skills than others.
So we do want to start wrapping up, but Nate, you mentioned that, you know, you think there are some valid critiques of data journalism, and I know that we don't actually maybe like that term data journalism much anymore. So just kind of as a last thought, what do you think are the actual lessons and the valid critiques of?
I mean, they are critiques of analysis more than critiques of the method, right? And by the way, I do want to push back on one thing where you say, well, we all kind of have this model in our head. When I say a model, I think the mistake we made was not having a model that is an equation, right? That is literally a formula. Not because the formula generates itself. There's a lot of thinking to do about how you set up that computer program, in essence, that algorithm. But in doing that, it disciplines you in a way to say, you know what, I'm going to have to formalize my knowledge and set up a way where as new events develop, it will evolve.
So you're saying you're thinking we should have been more kind of rigorous and just programmatic in terms of interpreting the Trump phenomenon?
More, you know, we have multiple gears, right? But I think we often, one of our favorite stupid Silicon Valley buzzwords in the office is uncanny valley, where something is not quite one thing and not quite another thing.
Like that Tom Hanks movie.
Like that Tom Hanks train. Movie. This was in that Tom Hanks movie zone where, you know, we
where
have this kind
for president.
Of, what are subjective odds, right? I mean, they're kind of empirical, but not really. I think it'd be better to say, hey, here's what a model says, and we know the model is kind of stupid and limited, but let's use that as a jumping off point because we kind of know what it incorporates and what it doesn't.
Just looking forward to the general election, for instance, even with these small data sets, you know, now if you look at my columns, you know, on the strongly unfavorable ratings or the polls at this point, you know, you can put those in, and I put them into, you know, and yes, it's a wacky kind of model with a small data set, but it does help ground me in understanding that, yeah, someone who is leading right now is probably has a better chance of winning than not, but it's not as high a percentage chance. So I'm a big fan of the equation thing, and I think that that's part of the reason why you see me sort of say, you know, on Twitter or my columns, you know, that I would feel that there's a greater chance than not of a Hillary Clinton presidency than a Donald Trump, but that it is far from a guarantee.
Claire, you want to add a last thought?
So little to say on this topic. I'm so disappointed in us.
The 538 team comprises Nate Silver, Harry Enten, and Claire Malone, and the host is Jody Avergan. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or by going to 538.com/podcasts. This has been an On the Media Podcast Extra. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.